This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. Today I'm talking to Elizabeth Hand about a new book of hers called Fire Plus. How are you, Elizabeth? Can I call you Liz?
Yes, please call me Liz. Everyone calls me Liz.
Even though on the book it says Elizabeth, but it does.
Well, I use that name professionally, but in real life, I'm the only people ever call me Elizabeth were the nuns when I was in trouble. So I go by Liz.
Then I definitely do not want to call you Elizabeth. So I just want to talk a little bit about this book because it is unusual. You know, it's such a short book and a collection of really interesting pieces. I take it this was commissioned by PM Press, the publisher, as part of their Outspoken Authors series. Did they come to you and say, we want to do a short book and you have, you know, do what you want? Or did they come to you and say, this is what we want you to do?
No, they came to me and basically said, we'd like you to do a book for the series, which I was delighted and very flattered because it's an amazing series with some incredible writers in it. Terry Bisson had, contacted me, and I've known Terry for a long time, and he, I think, is the commissioning editor for that series. And I believe he may have started it as well. But he said, one original story, more, if I'd come up with two, the short ones, I could have taken them. And then basically rounding up some other pieces enough to, make a book length work, a short book length volume. So there's a couple of essays in there and several other stories that sort of share similar themes to the one original story. And then a long interview with Terry, which was really fun because Terry's great and a very funny guy and a great interviewer.
Well, I love the interview.
As you are too, David.
Well, thank you for saying that. But I love the interview. And in some ways, I stay away from reading interviews with authors when I know I'm going to talk to them because I don't want to kind of be influenced by what other conversations have been had. But then this was part of the book, so I felt I needed to read it. And I thought it was terrific. I mean, it's a really great piece. And I learned a lot about you, which is, of course, one of the points of doing these conversations. And it gave me some good, ideas, for things that we could talk about. So, and maybe explore a little further. I'm very interested in your interest in cowboy boots, for example.
My mother is from Texas, southern Texas, and growing up, I spent a lot of time there. And then when I was a teenager and young adult, did as well. And I just got in the habit of every time I was down there, as I got older, buying a pair of cowboy boots. So I have a nice little collection now. And a friend of mine here in Maine, whose mom lives in Texas, when he goes down there to visit, he's always looking around for cowboy boots and thrift shops and flea markets and stuff. And he brings them back here and he cleans them up. And he used to sell them online and in a little shop here in town. But he was also very generous and would give them to his mostly lady friends. So I was, one of them was lucky enough to be the recipient.
It's funny. I have this sort of secret passion for cowboy boots, and I can't figure it out. I grew up in Connecticut. I have no connections other than that my sister-in-law lives in Tucson, Arizona, and years ago, she and my wife conspired to give me a pair of cowboy boots for a birthday present, and I loved them. They were just so fun to walk around in, and it started me kind of thinking about cowboy boots and how they change your outlook because you walk differently when you wear cowboy boots.
And yeah, you do. That's true.
And it just...
They're not good for the snow, but...
No, not at all.
But they're great.
and they're not too good they're not too good for dancing.
No.
They do have some drawbacks, and there are some problems with them, but it is interesting that... you know, aside from them being fashionable, and I know people are interested in them for fashion reasons, but I like the notion of how they were made, you know, that when they are made by hand in particular, they reflect a level of artistry that we don't see enough in our lives, you know, that so much is commoditized. And these are obviously shoes and boots are things that we use. They're everyday items, but in the hands of an artist or a craftsperson, you know, they become really special.
Yeah, they're beautiful. I don't have any of the really, you know, high-end fancy ones.
But no, neither do I.
I have some Tony Lamas and Nakomas and I forget what else. And they're nice. They're well made. They last forever. They're beautiful, beautiful stitching. But yeah, the ones that like the ones you're talking about, those really beautiful kind of bespoke cowboy boots. Those are amazing.
Yeah, and I like the old ones, you know, the ones, not new ones, but ones that have been worn and used and they have miles on them. I actually, you know, I know some people think it's really weird to buy used shoes, but I have bought a number of cowboy boots that were used on eBay, and it's just something about them that they kind of come with a story, almost like looking at a photograph when you go to a tag sale or an estate sale and you're looking at someone else's family and trying to imagine that who they were and what their story is. I feel the same way about the boots.
You should interview my friend Norm. he would love to talk to you about the cowboy boots. Cowboy boots, that's exactly how he feels about them. Well, the other thing too is if you get them used, because I've bought them used or, you know, had them given to me used as well, they're broken in. They're
right.
So much more comfortable. You're not having to spend years walking around breaking them in.
That's true.
So,
although
that's the other advantage.
The downside of that is that they're broken into someone else's foot shape. You know, we all have different...
Well, that's true.
You know,
yeah.
our gaits are different. Our ankles and feet are different. Anyway, it's just... So I'll keep my... You'll have to email me and tell me your shoe size, because when I go to Arizona next, you never know. I might be able to find you a pair
of
boots.
Okay, I'll do that. And you do likewise. I'll pass the information on to Norm.
Okay.
Next time he's in Bandera, the cowboy capital of the world.
All right.
He can look for you.
Well, you know, I'm going to go visit Terlingua, which is a ghost town in Texas, fairly soon. So maybe I need to bring a pair. I should probably wear cowboy boots on that trip.
Oh, you should. Yeah, I would definitely wear cowboy boots in a ghost town in Texas.
It's only appropriate. Well, I did want to talk about your fiction too. I thought that the story that you wrote for this book was both, I mean, it was terrifying, you know, in a lot of ways, and really powerful. And I think short stories are neglected by a lot of people. I think that they're ignored by people who like long form. But it seems like you write short stories quite a bit. Is that something that you're doing regularly?
Oh yeah. I've written a lot of short fiction. The length I'm probably most comfortable with is the novella, which is a long story, but that takes, you know, can take quite a while to do. And for this collection, for Fire, the idea that I had just happened to take shape as a much shorter story. So it uses a different part of my brain than novels. And it was, you know, it was fun writing something that was a lot shorter, that just, you know, I felt that it held up well on its own. It's sort of, it's kind of a monologue. It's a first-person narrator, and it works well as a monologue. I like to read my work aloud, you know, when I do public readings and things, and I tried that one out last month, and it went over well, so I feel like it worked. It came out okay.
And how you mentioned that you had collected other stories. I thought the Saffron Gatherers also fit very well. You know, it fit with the kind of theme that Fire establishes, this kind of a bit of dark, you know, present into the futureness. Is that, that was one you'd already written before and brought into this collection?
Yeah, that was written, that was in a collection of mine that came out, now I don't even remember how many years ago, 10 years ago, called Saffron and Brimstone. And it was a collection of previously published stories, except for The Saffron Gatherers, which was the only original story in that collection. And because it had not been previously published anywhere except in that book, it was not as well known, you know, as some of my other work. And it's a good story. And I wanted it to, you know, I was happy that it had a chance to kind of get out there in the world again. And it fit very well, as you said, with the other story, Fire, as sort of, you know, environmental fables or environmental horror, you know, understated horror stories, however you want to look at it. Quite a bit of my work has dealt with, you know, climate change issues and environmental issues in one way or the other. And so The Saffron Gatherers fell under that rubric, and Fire obviously did, the title story for the new collection. So, and then there was another story in there that was sort of a post 9/11 story, very short story. And so they all sort of, I felt, worked thematically well together.
So do you feel kind of, you know, I mean, this may be kind of almost trite to ask, but I still feel like it's an important question to ask, writers who are engaged, you know, with what's going on in the world. And that is, you know, now that we are in this kind of, I think what I just read this article called about the carbon bubble and kind of explaining where we are now on the basis around the idea of it are being in a carbon bubble. And I'm wondering whether in this time you feel that as a writer of fiction, your goals, your sense of responsibility, your imagination is challenged in a different way.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I feel like it's challenged because, you know, it's gotten very difficult to make stuff up. I wrote a novel called Glimmering that came out about 20 years ago. So I had started writing it, you know, longer ago than that. And it was a book that was about kind of climate change and eco-collapse. And it was a near-future novel at the time. It was published in 1997. It was set in 1999. And in that book, I took every single possible disaster, eco-disaster, and other disasters, too, including terrorists flying an airplane into a building, you know, a skyscraper in Lower Manhattan. I took all of these elements, and I thought, well, none of, you know, one or two of these things I could conceive of happening, you know, 50 years from now, but there's no way that they're gonna, you know, that they're gonna happen like this in this book. So I'm just gonna throw them all in this book, and I did. And you know, here we are now, 20 years later. And so many of the things that I had put in that book that I thought, this will never happen, this will never happen, and it's all happened. And I don't think that's because I was especially prescient. I was just, you know, the internet was a relatively new and, you know, new for, you know, common users like myself back then. So I would kind of research things and about climate change and say, oh, well, you know, this is kind of interesting. Maybe I'll run with this. But the fact that all of those things actually have happened now, and we're living, you know, we're living in what I think the term is the soft apocalypse.
Yeah.
That I just find mind-boggling. And it's a lot of my earlier books were what you would, you know, what's now become the trendy term, you know, are dystopian novels. And a lot of my early work was dystopian or post-apocalyptic fiction. And again, I was writing it at a time far enough removed from our current era that it was fun to write about it. You know, there was a sort of nihilistic pleasure and thinking like, oh my God, how bad can it be? You know, how bad can I write it? I don't take that kind of pleasure in writing it, that kind of stuff anymore. It's you know, it's like reality has sort of usurped literature, and I find it difficult to read and to think about writing a lot of that kind of thing. So yeah, I do read books like that, especially if I'm assigned to review them, and I enjoy them. There have been some, you know, some beautiful books that have come out recently that I've really loved. But I have to say I don't take the same kind of pleasure in it that I took when I was younger. And it's difficult to, you know, but the vision I had, and especially in those earlier books, and also in the stories that are in Fire, is very, very dark. And I think that I think it would be good for writers to step up to the plate and offer a more, you know, optimistic view of the future, just to give us something to aim for, you know, because it feels like a very hopeless moment in a lot of ways. I mean, in a lot of ways. And the environmental collapse that we're facing is so overwhelming that I think it's very hard for, I know it's very hard for me, and I think it's hard for other writers too, to figure out, you know, roll up our sleeves and think like, all right, how do we face this? Yeah. How do we deal with this without just writing another disaster scenario?
Or without going to a kind of, you know, a view that's overly optimistic either. You know, like you don't want to be Pollyanna even in fiction.
No. Although at this point, I don't know that anybody who is sane could write something Pollyanna, you know, Pollyanna-ish. I think it would be very difficult to write a believable near future utopia right now, to envision something like that. I mean, you could certainly write an alternate history. You could write something and set it at some point further in the future. But I would throw down the gauntlet and say I would love to read somebody, you know, read a book if somebody could write a convincing, you know, utopian novel that takes place sometime in the next decade.
Oh, well, you know, actually, I was thinking as you were talking, you know, with the soft apocalypse, I've thought the term of James Howard Kunstler's The Long Emergency. And he's written two, maybe three kind of post-apocalypse novels. He's taken the future as his nonfiction predicts it to occur, which is basically collapse, and then posited humans existing in that future world, you know, the collapsed world. And while there is this level of, you know, you might call it dystopianism, the books are actually fairly positive in the sense that, you know, there's death and rebirth. And even though not the rebirth can't be imagined as something fun to have gotten to in any way, shape, or form, you know, good things survive. People who are good find a way to make a future in these books. And
right.
So I think it is, you know, there is an example. I'm not saying that it's exactly what you're talking about, but, you know, the only way to imagine that future is to get through the, you know, to get through the present and into that future somehow.
Yeah. No, I agree. We have to get through this and then get to the other side. There is a beautiful book that was written about, I'm just looking now, 1996, called Into the Forest by Jean Hegland, which I think I'm pretty sure I know I read it back then. I think I reviewed it when it came out. And it's a really beautifully written post-apocalypse novel that felt very, you know, very realistic in a lot of ways, although it ended up having this sort of mythic, almost a magic realist element entering into it, but towards the end. But it was actually a very, to me, it was a very believable, low-key depiction of a collapse that I think was caused by an epidemic. I think there was some epidemic, some outbreak that killed most of the, you know, human population. but which ended up not being such a bad thing. So in the long run, it was not, you know, maybe it wasn't such a bad thing.
Right. What was that? So, there was a novel that came out maybe a year and a half or 2 years ago, California or something. I can't remember the title of it. I read it and I really liked it. And it is a similar idea, post-epidemic, you know, people kind of surviving in the wilderness of Northern California.
That sounds cool.
It was good. I have a copy of it. Now I can't remember the full name of it, but it actually sold really well. It was pretty popular. And, you know, I've gone back and reread Ecotopia by Ernst Kallenbach, which is an amazing book to read now. It was written in the maybe early 80s, late 70s. And it imagines Northern California and Oregon and Washington or breaking away from the United States and forming an Ecotopia. You know, and it's a kind of amazing idea. You know, those kinds of things are, I think it's useful to imagine, you know, a kind of evolutionary future for us rather than to look at things as everything as disaster.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, I think, well, my friend, Robert Olson, who was the person who got me onto the involved with the think tank project, the Fire Futures project, he was somebody who sort of threw down the gauntlet to me some years ago now, saying, you know, you should write something. You need to look at this from a different perspective, you know, from a more optimistic perspective, from a more evolutionary perspective, and not just, you know, not just ash and, you know, smoking ruins.
So, well, I think I can understand that, although I think you got to write what you feel.
Yeah. Well, that's sad to say, that's true.
I can't remember where it was in the book. I think this is kind of sums up perhaps your ideas. The world we live in is an experiment that's spinning out of control.
Did I say that?
Or maybe that
was quoting somebody.
Yeah, it might have
I can't
been.
Remember.
That might have been you quoting James Tiptree. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But it really struck me as a great line, you know, that that says what it, you know, what it is. I don't know whether. Not necessarily, you know, so there's no value placed on it. It's just, it is what it is, you know, and you're just trying to figure it out without judgment.
Yeah, just reporting the news.
So did you, I mean, you write fiction, nonfiction, you write book reviews. You know, how did you become a writer? How did this happen?
I, you know, have a sort of standard origin story of wanting to have been a writer since I was very young. And actually, I think one of the essays in Fire talks about that. And I didn't actually get published, I think, until I was 30, or in my early 30s. So, it, you know, from the perspective today of a lot of, you know, emerging writers, young writers, everybody wants to get published when they're, you know, 17, which I did too. But it took me a while, you know, before I got there. I collected a lot of rejection slips and, but I kind of kept banging my head against the wall until I finally broke through. And I was very, you know, I was very lucky. I still think I'm very lucky. I don't, you know, the kind of writing that I do, I wonder if I was setting out today, if I would be able to get published the way that I did back then. You know, I got published and well-received and well-reviewed, and I don't know that the kind of work that I do would meet that reception now. I'm not sure that the market, I think the market has changed. You know, I don't know that it's changed for the worse. It's just, I think it's different. So I feel very fortunate that I came out when I did, so, which is now, I think my first story was published maybe 30 years ago. So, so a while back. Can't believe I'm that old.
None of us can. But, and you did, I mean, it sounds like you talked about this in the book also, that you recommend to writers, you know, to go to cons, go to conventions, the book, you know, the science fiction conventions, comic cons, whatever it may be, because that's where everybody is. You know, that's where your community can be found. I think you mentioned that's how you found your agent.
Yeah, I did. I found my agent. I met Mike Derda, who is a Pulitzer Prize winning critic who, you know, ended up becoming a friend. He was one of the book review editors at the Washington Post. I met him many years ago at a convention. I mean, I think nowadays you can get a sense of a lot of that same sense of community online, which I think is great. I think that, you know, you're able to interact with people, and I think that's a wonderful thing. But I think there is nothing quite like being able to meet people face to face and really interact with them and, you know, fall in love with them or argue with them or hang out, you know, stay out all night with them. And I did not grow up going to cons. You know, I don't think I went to one until I was, first one I went to was in 1988. So I was, you know, 31 years old. And I don't, you know, I go to a couple a year now. I was never a really big con goer, but I think it is a great thing. And I think, you know, a lot of my closest friends who are writers and some who are not writers, some who are readers, you know, fans, not necessarily of me, are people who I've met at various literary conventions. So I think it's a great thing to do. It's just, it's a lot of fun, you know, and especially if you are, you know, if you are into science fiction or fantasy or horror or comics, you know, graphic novels, genre writing of any sort, you know, the mystery crime writers have their own, they have BoucherCon and, you know, what's it called? Malice Domestic and different
there's
conventions.
ThrillerCon and...
yeah, right. Yeah. There's a whole bunch of them. There's so, if you're, you know, a reader who loves reading a particular kind of book, or if you're a writer or an emerging writer, or just, you know, bored for a weekend that's going on in your town or neighboring town, I highly recommend it. It's a lot of fun, you know. It's a lot of fun, and the people are interesting, and there's just a whole range of you know, from really small conventions to really huge ones. I've been to Comic-Con, but I haven't been there since it's really exploded into this, you know, gigantic, I don't know, 500,000 people going to, you know, see the new whatever movie is being released that year. So that's my little plug for cons. I think they're fun.
Well, no, and I think what you're talking about is the value of community and, you know, that writers, I mean, you know, you have that contradiction that writing is a solo practice. You have to, you know, it's between you and the, well, computer or typewriter or whatever it is you write on, but it's between you and the page. And yet there's this social element to it because it's communication. It's, you know, it's cultural. And I think the cons and writers' festivals, you know, all the book fairs, all that stuff, I think is really where, you know, that's the literary world that results from all of that solo practice. And I think the two you have to find a way of doing both.
Yeah, I agree. And it's also, writing is a, you know, it's a solo practice. It could also be very solitary and it can be lonely. I mean, it's less so now because, again, because of the internet. But I can remember when I first quit my job and started writing full time in the 80s. And, you know, I had a job and had, you know, a lot of friends, people who I, you know, friends from work and other, you know, friends from other places. But here I was sitting at home and, you know, sitting in front of a very early computer. And all of a sudden it was like, wow, there's like nobody to talk to. I can't pick up the phone really and call anybody because they're all at work, you know, and here I am and you can write, but there's, you know, you, at least I could not, cannot write 8 hours a day straight unless I'm really on a heavy deadline. So it was really kind of a surprise to realize how lonely it could be, you know, that there were not, you know, there wasn't somebody to go and hang out at around the water cooler. You know, there wasn't somebody that you would run into, you know, when you were getting a cup of coffee or going off to lunch. That's changed. I think, you know, we now have this gigantic water cooler in the web, but and maybe that's, you know, in some ways maybe that's not such a good thing, because I think when you lose a certain amount of isolation, probably, you know, we're relying a bit too much on other ways of, you know, feeding our desire for companionship, which maybe might be better put into our fiction or nonfiction.
Yeah, I think that's probably a common concern that we all fear, that, you know, this all the web stuff just is a big time suck, and it has a sort of false ability to make you think that you're being social and active and doing things, and you're really, it's not as powerful as in person, nor is it as meaningful as what you can do when you're by yourself, kind of reflecting and being the self that is exploring and trying to become. You know, you can get distracted, and it you know, all of those nice or not so nice people end up taking you away from yourself.
Yeah, it's, I don't spend a lot. I mean, I spend some time on social media, but I'm fortunate in that I have not yet, so far anyway, really run too much into trolls. You know, I have nice conversations with people online, and you know, the rest of the time, a lot of it is just, it's obviously great for research. You know, living in Maine, where I did not have access to a world-class library, and, you know, the bookstores were fine, but they were not, you know, they were not bookstores where I could really find the kind of books that I wanted or needed for research. And then all of a sudden, you know, I can do research online. I can buy books online. I can, you know, download PDFs of, you know, legally, books and articles online. So that's fantastic. And that to me is more, that's more of a rabbit hole than any, you know, other kind of social media stuff, because I could just get caught up reading things. Even if I'm sitting and reading a book, or I'm reading, you know, the Times Literary Supplement or the, you know, London Review of Books or something, and I'll come across a reference to a book or a writer or something I've never heard of before, and then I can put, you know, finish that and put it aside and go online and Google it and then start researching that person or that book and then, you know, buying that book to read on the Kindle. It's, I mean, that's a good kind of distraction, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Or,
so maybe I'm just deluding myself. but I think that's a good thing. You know, it's like having the Library of Alexandria just there at your fingertips. But you do have to kind of steer away from the temptations of, I don't know, Gawker.
Yeah.
Whatever is out there.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. Well, it is, mm-hmm. It is a wonderful thing. You know, like everything else, anything that's good has this other side to it, you know, which could be not so good.
Yeah.
So I know we really have only one more question, or time for one more question. I wanted to ask you about what are you working on now, if you're willing to talk about it, and kind of what is motivating you right now in terms of your fiction writing?
My motivation, actually, some perhaps apocryphal story about Alfred Hitchcock with a starlet asking him about a scene, what is my motivation? He said, your paycheck. So my motivation is Baby Needs Snowshoes. So right. I'm actually working on the fourth Casneri novel, which is a series of noir novels, that I write that are very dark and, you know, fun to write in a dark way. They have their own sort of, soft apocalyptic background, So I'm working on that, and it deals a bit with the rise of white supremacists in the UK and in Sweden, and so that's what I'm doing. I've been doing, you know, some research into that, and now I've been, you know, holed up down at my cottage working on it. Yeah.
Well, I learned a little bit about those from, you know, looking. I had not read, I you know, that's just a category of fiction I'm not well read in. And so I did not know about the Cass Neary books. Now that I do, I'm afraid I'm going to have to start reading them. So I'll let you.
Oh, that would be a terrible thing, David.
I know, it is terrible. No. No, I'm really actually looking forward to it because I have finished all of the Alan First novels that there are. And even though your books have nothing to do with that, I'm just looking for another series of books with the same sort of, you know, similar character, same character, or same setting. I want to read a series again. So maybe.
I'll put a plug in here for, which if you like Alan First, you might like these. My ex, Richard Grant, who is a wonderful writer, who lives in the same town where I do here in Maine. He had a book come out about 10 years ago called Another Green World, which was set in Germany just before World War II. Got great reviews, beautiful book. And he has a new book coming out now, like right now, like next week, about that's set during the Second World War. And his work has been compared to Alan First. So you might want to check him out.
Yeah,
the new book is called Cave Dwellers, which is sort of an odd title, but anyway, it's gotten, you know, got a starred review from Kirkus, so it's good. And if you do like Alan First, if that's your kind of taste, you might want to check it out.
All right, that's a good tip. No, I like those are kind of books I read for fun. So, I will definitely look into Richard Grant. That's a great idea. Thank you. Yeah. And I will, but I still want to read your books, your Cass Neary books.
Yeah, so. You can read those too. Yeah. You can read them as well.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for talking to me. I really like this, as we call it, little book, Fire Plus, and I will recommend it to everyone I know. But it's really great to kind of learn who you are as a writer from this book. And if you've already read Elizabeth Hand, you will find this book supplementary. If you've never read her before, I think this is a great introduction. So thank you, Liz, for talking to me. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Liz Hand about Fire Plus.